So our next speaker is Joshua Willis, who will report on recent work on computing rents in this window.
Thank you for allowing me to speak to you. You've heard now three different talks preceding me on computations involving spin foams. All of the preceding computations have really been in the framework, well, so Wade's was in the lattice gauge theory, but the spin foam computations are talking about in the Riemannian setting. So we would like ultimately to be able to do some computations as well in the Lorentzian setting. So the outline of my talk, I'm going to talk about why this is hard, and in particular seems to remain harder than the corresponding Riemannian case. I'm going to summarize what we do seem to have working in the Lorentzian case, which is calculating the tetrahedral network, the analog of the 6J symbol. Our reason for being interested in that is to use the analog of the appropriate kind of recoupling theory for SL2C to generalize the Christensen-Egan algorithm, which is the efficient algorithm that's used in the Riemannian calculations for actually calculating the 10J symbol that we're interested in for four-dimensional gravity. So we've got a derivation basically of that algorithm. I have made an implementation of it, but it's not yet ready for public viewing. So I'll talk a little bit about what some of the issues are there involved and what the outlook that I expect for it. So you've seen this equation several times now today, and probably a few more times before this conference is over. We're calculating a partition function for a spin foam. We are looking at two complexes in space-time, and again, face, edge, and vertex amplitudes. Why are we interested in these? So Dan, I think, hopefully convinced you that certainly there are calculations that we know already we're interested in, and even ones that we sort of were doing to just study our numerical methods have surprised us and given us reason, sort of caused you to go back and take a look at your analytic formulation and change some things. So we'd like to have available this numerical approach to studying these spin foam models. Of course, the ultimate calculation that you'd like to do is to do a sum over product over many different colorings, multiply these things together, add them all up. Right now, especially for the Lorentzian case, the problem is that if I'm interested in a sum over these things, but calculating just one is hard because of this vertex amplitude, the 10J symbol. It remains a computationally, it's not intractable to calculate one, but it's slow and doesn't converge very well. Why is that? So for the Riemannian methods, Riemannian models, the methods that we use to calculate the efficient algorithms starts by taking the 10J, expanding it using the Barrett-Crane vertex, and then recoupling the resulting graph and expressing it as a sum of 6J symbols. You can also, when you're doing that, you can draw on many different or much existing work for when you're working in the Riemannian context, because you can re-express everything in terms of SU2 spin networks. There's a lot of recoupling theory and a lot of that's known about SU2 representation theory that's just been developed over a long time. So even before people were really interested in doing these kind of computations, there's a lot known on 6J and 9J symbols, as well as the generic recoupling theory. For Lorentzian methods, first of all, I think we now know the analog of that algorithm, but part of the problem is that the infrastructure you need to study these algorithms, this recoupling theory for SL2C, it really hasn't been as well developed. If you wanted to just start with the definition that we already had at hand, so people have defined them. It, in fact, took some work to prove that they're finite to begin with. So they're expressed as one way of expressing them is integrating together products of these kernels, which are, I'm just writing the expression down here, not really motivating it. It does come out of the representation theory for SL2C. You multiply these kernels together, so for each vertex in your diagram, so the 6J given by the tetrahedral diagram, you've got the four vertices. Instead of having a copy of SU or spin 4, SU2, S3, as you did for the Riemannian case, you have to have copies of hyperbolic space. So naively, the integral doesn't even converge. In fact, you can show that if the way that I've written it, these never converge because there's a free rotation, which you can factor out, but that will break the symmetry, and that's sort of a computational problem. But aside from that, anytime, even if you just started to take the analogous expression for the Riemannian case, you can also write these as integrals over products of the group, but that's not used as the basis for computation because you end up with integrals that are high dimensional and the integrand oscillates. So computationally, both of those things are problematic. So you've got I can get that to a 6-dimensional integral here or a 9-dimensional integral here by using various symmetry things, but 9 is a very high dimension or comparatively high dimension for doing computations. And the integrate oscillates, and that gets worse and worse the higher the spin is, so you get a lot of cancellation there. So we started, or I started by looking at a better algorithm for the Lorentzian 6J and did this really starting about 2.5-3 years ago. Using some group theoretic techniques that's particularly come from the group field theory, that it's more natural to express these proper the 10J symbol not as an integral over products of hyperbolic space, but of matrix elements defined on the group manifold SL2C. And when you do that, you can, through some manipulations, expand out and get a formula which says that the 6J, or the tetrahedral network, is proportional to this sum over a product of 3 Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So let me say a little bit about the notation there. The proportionality constant that I'm dropping that's out front depends on your choice of Haar measure and also on some Clebsch-Gordan coefficients with everything set equal to 0 lowest. We know what that is. I'm just dropping it to make the formula fit a little better here. On the top of my Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are labeling what representation I'm talking about. So SL2C representations are characterized by a half integral parameter and a real number parameter, the unitary representations, I should say. And you'll notice the half integral parameter is always 0. That corresponds to having what's called a simple spin network and implementing a simplicity constraint in spin foam models. So all the spin foam models have that in there. That's why I'm only interested in computing with those sorts of networks, although we'll see the need to compute with non-simple ones in a moment. Now, so therefore, each of these parent, hopefully you can see a little bit of spacing. This corresponds to, therefore, the recoupling between an SL2 label by 0 row 1, 0 row 5, 0 row 4. So I've got 6 spins there corresponding to my 6 spins labeling my tetrahedral network. Then in the bottom, when I've expanded this out into a sum, so I'm thinking of this really as a sum of operators, these labels and generically would be J and M corresponding to a particular choice of basis of the Hilbert space infinite on which these representations act. Now, why is this a better algorithm than this integral over 3 copies of hyperbolic space that I had on the previous transparency? Well, I've replaced this multiple dimensional integral with a single sum. But one thing that's different here in the case of SL2C from the compact case, this sum is from J equals 0 to infinity. So when I'm implementing this on a computer, I have to have some strategies for knowing when I think I want to terminate that sum, when it's converged enough, because obviously I can't just sum up all the terms. That never gets done. The other issue is that the reason that this algorithm turns out to be, comparatively so much more efficient. The Clebsch-Gordan coefficients themselves, for SU2, people worked that out in the 40s and 50s. You have explicit expressions for them. There are explicit expressions for these as well for SL2C. They're not particularly, they don't help you any. They express it as a much more complicated sum. But instead what we do is to calculate these Clebsch-Gordan coefficients recursively. So I have to sum over this parameter J, and so I know how to calculate it in closed form when J is equal to 0, and I have a recursion that lets me calculate J equal to 1 and 2, so forth like that. So that's how we do that. And it will, as I'll show you, it's much more efficient than the direct integration, but the convergence is still slow. This sum turns out to oscillate, even the running total oscillates, so we have to further speed up this convergence using the asymptotic form of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. I haven't written that down. It would take most of a slide by itself. The hardest part by far of this work is figuring out what those coefficients are and coding that in properly. And that's one thing that still needs to be improved, I think, how that's handled to make this algorithm a little bit faster. But I'll show you an old calculation to sort of compare. So on the top left corner, so this is if I'm evaluating the tetrahedral network with all of the spins equal to each other and equal to 1. This is the brute force Monte Carlo looking at that six-dimensional integral, and this is how many function evaluations of the integrand I perform, showing you the value, and then the percent error here, that quote is the Monte Carlo methods come with their own estimate of the error, so that's what it thinks its error is, and the running time on that CPU. And you can see that even with all of them equal to 1, it is converging, but it doesn't converge particularly well. Right here is this sort of direct summation algorithm where I just use the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and add them all up, but I don't make any use of this knowledge of the asymptotic nature. And you can see already, for instance, that you get basically adding up 100 terms comparable accuracy to what you got with 10 to the 8th function calls over here, much less time for that. But it's still, looking at this, you wouldn't necessarily see the need for all spins equal to one for why you would need to do this accelerated convergence. That shows up when you look at higher spins where the convergence is not nearly as quick, all of them equal to 10, or especially when they start not being equal. That tends to be a problem. But you can see that if you go ahead and do it, so this is using this accelerated summation, taking use of this asymptotic information, there's no difference, right? You can see there in that example between all of them. So I get 10 digits of accuracy, essentially in the order of about a tenth of a millisecond. So that's sort of the time to keep in mind for evaluating one of those function calls, which is fast compared to this time, but we'll see it doesn't seem to quite be fast enough in some other calculations. So that's the tetrahedral network. That's what I started working on. As I say, we're going to revisit it, but the main reason for working on it for SL2C gauge group particularly is to use it as part of calculating the 10J. So can we do that? How do we get to an analog of Dan and Greg's algorithm for doing that? Well, theirs relied heavily on recoupling theory for SU2, so we need to get some understanding of what is recoupling theory like, at least the parts of it that we need for SL2C. And you can do this, I'll give you an example of the sort of main idea, but all of the things that I'm doing start with explicit expressions in terms of multiplying together matrix elements on the group and using known identities like that and involving Clebsch-Gordan coefficients and orthogonality and things of that nature. I'll show you an example here in the next slide. But it's basically a sort of long, messy way of validating a diagrammatic technique, which is what you'd really like to be using in the first place. But the existing literature, and there is existing literature going mostly in the 70s about the representation theory of SL2C that we're relying on. So let me give you an example. As I said, we're working in terms of matrix elements on SL2C rather than that particular kernel expression on the hyperbolic space that's known for a while that you can do that if you want. Here's an example of an identity if you spend lots of time studying matrix elements and Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Something like exactly like this is true for SU2. If I multiply together two different group matrix element for two different representations and possibly evaluate at different labels here, I get this, I can express it in terms of one, but at the price of introducing this sum and integral over Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So again, I didn't derive this formula. This you can find in the literature. The point is that this lets me take the product of two matrix elements, and these representation basis labels appear when I split the 10J symbol up and start thinking of it as a composition of operators. So I get those labels appearing there because I'm summing over those as I glue together these different vertices. So I can get this formula. If I apply that twice to a four-valent vertex, I show that I can, in fact, rewrite the Barrett-Crane, four-vertex as an integral over a new spin that I've introduced and now a trivalent vertex like that. And again, my point is just illustrating that I can use stuff that is known from SL2C to derive this sort of formula, which is exactly analogous to the kind of formula you have taking the regular four-valent vertex and expanding that by adding an incident edge and summing up there. So in particular, the lambda squared factor is the Plancherel measure for SL2C for this particular case. These Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, you would normally leave those in this vertex. I pull them out because for recoupling theory, it's going to turn out to be more convenient to have them outside, which means I'm effectively redefining the normalization of this vertex. So that one, I didn't really even prove that to you, but it's, it gives you sort of an idea. It's harder but still doable to prove the analog of recoupling, which says if I've got this diagram, so I've still got four incident edges, and I want to pair them off in the opposite fashion to how they come in with two trivalent vertices. How can I do that? Well, you can prove that you get this sum in an integral where I've added an additional edge, and this edge has to be labeled in general with a non-simple representation. So always before I've been able to restrict my attention to using these things where that half integral parameter can be zero, which is convenient certainly, but here to get the in order for this equation to be true, you have to include the non-simple representations. This 6J symbol, at least in the case when nu is equal to zero, is in fact proportional to the tetrahedral network that we've already talked about. So here I wanted to also comment a little bit about this, that it's unavoidable. An analogous situation occurs in the Riemannian case. That may not be familiar to you, that statement that an analogous thing happens in the Riemannian case. That's because usually we don't think of it for very long as a spin 4. spin network. We immediately in the first step expanded into two spin two networks, and then you can recouple those separately. But when you recouple them separately, that extra edge that you add no longer is the same. So if I thought of it as recoupling one spin four four valent vertex to another, that extra edge that I added would be labeled by two different half-integral parameterizations. So again, the recoupling theory, even in spin four, involves a non-simple representation when I add edges in like that. Once we have that, though, we can kind of basically copy the derivation that Greg and Dan gave for an algorithm for the 10J. Now, here I'm sort of showing you the diagrammatic picture. I'm dropping lots of important factors that I will restore on the final answer on the first slide. But the idea is you start with the 10J, the four valent nodes, and you expand each of these four valent nodes using that first equation that I showed, that I can take any four valent one and expand it in terms of three valent vertices. But that means that each of these new edges that I've introduced, there is, in fact, in front of this network, an integral over all possible values of that. The next step is really quite simple. I'm just taking this and redrawing the same diagram, and I've split. You can choose to split anywhere. I've just chosen to split this row 2, 4. One slightly subtle thing that I've done is where I've split it so that I can think of it as just an operator that I'm following through, I've labeled it by row 2, 4 prime and row 2, 4 at the top. Why have I done that? Well, by Schur's lemma, I know that this whole network right here has to be proportional to the Dirac delta of rho minus rho 2, 4 prime. In the case of SU2 spin 4 spin networks, it's the Kronecker delta. The reason for doing that is that in order for things to be finite, I said that I can fix one vertex and then things are finite, but I haven't fixed that vertex because it messes up the symmetry of using this algorithm, so I just need to keep up with where that Dirac delta function appears so that I know the part that's left over is what's equal to the finite version of the 10J symbol. And when you do that, then you can apply the recoupling of these horizontal edges, and so I get this long chain like this, and that's what forces these nu and mu's to all be equal to each other. The price for that recoupling is, again, a bunch of 6J symbols that I have not written here because I'm just sort of showing what happens to the diagrams on this slide. And then with the normalization conventions that I've chosen where I sort of redefine the three vertex, this whole thing just basically is equal to the Dirac delta. And so in particular, all the 6J symbols that I got that I haven't shown are what should be the 10J symbol. So this is the formula, essentially, that you end up with. I'm not writing all the product of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that come from that. They're all Clebsch-Gordan coefficients where all the representation basis labels are equal to zero. But I have five new spins that I've introduced by where I've expanded those vertices, and I'm also summing and integrating over a non-simple unitary representation of SL2C. And I get, if you went through and looked at Greg and Dan's paper, this would be almost exactly analogous to, in terms of the labeling, their algorithm they have. So I've re-expressed it as I've re-expressed the 10J as a product of 6J symbols, which are the things that we know how to compute. Now, I still have, though, an integral over something, so it's not that I've simply solved the problem. Why should this be better or worse? Well, I'll go ahead and tell you what I'm going to say on the next slide. At the moment, the implementation isn't better, but we have reasons to think that maybe we can change that. But notice I've gone from it would have been a nine-dimensional oscillatory integral if I was thinking about the just the straightforward definition in terms of kernel. So this is a six-dimensional integral and one-dimensional sum. So that's a little bit lower dimensional. And probably in the end, more importantly, if you sort of study the asymptotics of these 6Js, is you let only certain of the spins get large, because again, I'm only integrating over certain copies of these spins. Others are held fixed and correspond to some of the spins on the 10J. Then it dies off exponentially. And so that sort of suggests that we can, when these triangle inequalities are violated. So that sort of, hopefully we'll be able to take advantage of that exponential decay to concentrate where we do the Monte Carlo integration. I should say that at the moment I'm just concentrating on ignoring the sum over nu, just setting nu equal to zero, because that allows us to rely on the existing code. But we're going to have to think eventually about the nu not equal to zero, so how big of a contribution does that make? Oh, okay. So I've got some... This has been implemented, I should say it's been implemented recently, by which I mean in the last week and a half. So that's why it's sort of not quite ready for me to give you sort of final conclusions. And at the moment, it does not seem to be faster than the existing algorithm, but there are a few things that haven't done, or at least haven't done as well as I'd like to do them before I decide that you know, all is lost. I really don't think that, but I don't know it. So first of all, in the 6J symbols, the main reason, why doesn't this just work out of the box better if I'm using a lower dimensional integral? Well, I showed you this 6J calculation and said that it's very fast. It's basically a tenth of a millisecond in sort of best case scenarios. And that's certainly a lot faster than the 6J symbol evaluated by other methods. But if I'm doing the nine dimensional integral that sort of most straightforwardly defines the 10J symbol, it's a higher dimensional, more oscillatory integral, but what I'm evaluating is very simple and something that can be done in several orders of magnitude faster time. Actually, I haven't even timed it, but it's something that can be done on the floating point processor. It'll be very fast. So a tenth of a millisecond is slow compared to that. So you have to know that your 6J is fast enough, or that your lower dimensional integral is fast enough to make up for that. So there's sort of two things you can do the integral more cleverly and to speed up the 6J, and I hope to be able to do both of those. The first thing, I think there's a better way of handling this asymptotic calculation than what I'm doing right now. I realize I haven't said a whole lot about what that is. It's fairly complex. It involves computationally evaluating the Riemann zeta function, because that's what shows up as the sort of simpler version of the sum that you're calculating. So I think that can be improved. And hopefully reduce the number of terms that you have to sum in the 6J to get an answer. So I'm going to study that. The other thing is to study the important sampling technique. So I said that the integrand sort of decays exponentially in certain regions, but it's a little complicated when you multiply together several of these 6Js that become exponential in different regions, and you sort of have to be a little clever in figuring out how to do that correctly. If you do it naively and do important sampling where you don't quite get it correctly, then you make things worse, not better, because you're, in general, you're important sampling something where it shouldn't be assuming something smaller, where in fact it really isn't. So you're certainly not helping yourself there. I leave open the possibility of other methods of evaluating the 6J. I'm not working on that as actively, but for instance, in the SU2 6J, you can calculate that directly from a recursion relation, which comes ultimately from the Beeden-Harn-Elliott identity for recoupling for SU2. There's a similar identity for SL2C. I don't know whether or not that would allow you to derive something like a differential equation that the tetrahedral network satisfies, and if it did, I don't know if that would be faster than this summation method or not, but, you know, again, it's sort of the issue that in the existing Riemannian calculations, there's a huge body of multiple ways of calculating lots of things to draw on, and you have to sort of reinvent those, and it's often possible to look at the general methods of proof and make some adjustments, but you have to do that, and it hasn't been done in a lot of cases yet. So I'm hoping that this is on the time order of a couple of months, that I can see if at least these first two things will help any, and hopefully in at least some regime be able to calculate the 10J more effectively and open up some of the same kinds of calculations, which are what we'd really like to do in the Lorentzian case. Thank you.
Are you already using Vegas or something like that for these six-dimensional
variables? Well, I'm not using that. I tried Vegas, and it didn't seem to. It would run for a while, and I never really finished, and gave me sort of a nonsense answer that I don't really understand yet. I don't know if that's a GSL thing or not.
I mean, for this important sampling, it seems like you could try to be clever and estimate decays, but Vegas is just designed to do that, right? I mean,
yeah, but you may have to sample a long time in a place where it's hard to calculate, and I think that may be why it was taking so long. One thing, the asymptotics that I didn't mention are fairly easy for the 6J to see where they come from, in the sense that they're basically dominated by the asymptotics of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. You just sort of pull those out in front, and that's, if you say what is the asymptotics of that, that turns out to be equal to what you see for the asymptotics of the complicated whatever's happening inside that sum, which is really giving you the answer, isn't contributing much to the asymptotics. And that's nice because you have closed form formulas in terms of, you know, hyperbolic trig functions for those. So you can sort of know what exponentially decays and what the decay parameter should be.
You're gonna hate being this question.
Okay.
I'm sort of concentrating it while doing the OPM. Mm-hmm. And then drawing the risks. One reason that I'm not thinking a mistake to policy when we get here. You would instead of the non-linear high-dimensional ones. You're going to hate me. So the question is that is there an analogous, this object exists and there are capital also for the non-linear high-dimensional ones, and would that
My recollection is that the non-unitary representations, right, are not bounded on the group, the matrix elements, I think. So I don't know. I think it would be harder to prove this convergence if you multiply it. Right. I don't know that anyone has tried to, so I'm just was trying to compute the existing model, of course. Right. I don't know. I don't know what the analog would be. Certainly, I think some of the issues are still going to persist in terms of, in other words, if I look at the Riemannian case, where the unitary representations are finite dimensional, if I try and calculate it nonetheless numerically, directly from that formula, that doesn't make things easy all of a sudden just because they're finite dimensional. You still have this oscillatory high dimensional integral. So would there be some analog of this other algorithm in that case? And would it be comparable? I don't know. You'd have to sort of, as far as I've not seen in the literature really an actual presentation of the recoupling theory like I presented for SL2C just now. There's stuff about Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. If you had the definition, I think you could try and invent it, but it hasn't been invented to my knowledge, so I don't know without that how straightforward it would be numerically.
Other questions?